At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Axis Mundi.
Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, a constitutional attorney and the author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade. This is a podcast about religion, the law, and the battle for America's soul. We'll be separating church and state, defending freedom and equality, and fighting Christian nationalism. If you haven't already, sign up for our weekly bonus content and ad-free listening at accessmundi.us. LFG, folks. As I was outlining the episode for the pod this week, news broke about a bad decision out of the Ninth Circuit, a decision involving a Christian who wants to adopt or foster children, but also wants to raise children according to her anti-LGBTQ religious beliefs, even if those children are LGBTQ. And as I was looking at the decision and looking at the briefs in the case, and I recalled, oh yeah, I remember this case. There's a brief that was filed by Americans United for Separation of Church and State, jointly with the Freedom From Religion Foundation, two great organizations, and one of the attorneys on that brief happens to be both a brilliant lawyer and one of my best friends. Sam Grover is a constitutional attorney at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Sam got a BA in philosophy and government from Wesleyan and a JD from Boston University. And Sam's done some really fascinating work in some really cool places like Botswana's High Court, and did some work on counterterrorism for the Memorial Institute for the Prevention of Terrorism in Oklahoma City. And fun fact, when Sam moved to Madison to work at FFRF, he moved into our guest room. He has been my partner in the paddle and portage race here in Madison. So there are photos of us running with a canoe on our heads. And when he got married to a person who is somehow even more amazing than he is, I performed the ceremony, kind of. That's a story for another day. Sam Grover, welcome, my friend, to One Nation Indivisible.
Wow, what an outrageous introduction, Andrew. That's, you're really overselling me, I think.
No. This is like the best thing about the podcast. Like, I this is my podcast. I can invite my friends on. You know, Liz comes on, who, she's so much smarter and more articulate than I am, and we just get to rip on the Supreme Court, like, here in our basement while we're having beverages. Sam is now on. He's so much smarter and more articulate than I am. I love this. It's a great gig.
I mean, and let me say, I love your podcast. I download every episode, listen to them. It's going to be weird, hearing it on 1.5 speed. I've never heard my own voice that fast, but
it's really distracting. That came on. I listened to Liz's podcast too, and it came on at 1.5 when I was in the car with the kids, and they were like, "What's wrong with mom?" Nothing. It's just, that's the way that we listen to books and podcasts these days. Okay, but Sam, I want to talk to you about this case, Bates versus, and I'm going to ask you to say the second name, Bates versus
Pak Suresht.
Okay, we'll get to the decision. We'll get to the brief that you helped write, but before we do that, can you just talk about, like set the table for us? What happened in the case? How did this case get to court? What's going on?
Yeah. So on the one side of the case, you have Christian bigot Jessica Bates, right? She lives in Oregon. She has kids. And like every other state, Oregon, through its Department of Human Services, has requirements, you know, a long vetting process for anyone who wants to be to adopt a child from the state's foster care system. So Oregon has requirements, numerous requirements, in order to be a suitable parent. And among those requirements is that a foster care parent must agree to respect, accept, and support a child, regardless of, you know, a number of things, including their, you know, religious beliefs, their background, their ethnicity, cultural identities, but then also, importantly for this case, their sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression.
So it's a simple rule. It's if you want to adopt kids, you've got to support them if they're LGBTQ, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. In order to be a foster care parent in the state of Oregon and most other states, you need to be pledging unconditional support for the child who ends up in your care.
That seems pretty reasonable and like something that seems kind of good, you know, like we want that.
Yeah, we would like it if the parents entering the foster care system were willing to just be unconditionally supportive of children. And, you know, the state has an obligation to ensure that the parents are going to fulfill their role as custodians and, you know, provide a loving and supportive home, right? It's ultimately the state's responsibility to ensure that these kids are well cared for.
And so we've got this requirement and we've got this bigot who doesn't want to follow it. And she applies to be an adoptive parent and says everything, I'll do that, but I won't do this thing because my God says so.
Exactly. Yeah. So she's willing to fulfill a bunch of her other obligations, but specifically, she doesn't want to support children who are LGBTQ+.
So, you know, from time to time, like I opened American Crusade with stories about people letting Jesus take the wheel. And like, you know, like I'm imagining somebody going in to the DMV and saying, I'll take the driver's test. I'll do everything necessary, but you can't score me on the driver's test for the section where I let Jesus take the wheel. That part does, because it's my religious belief that Jesus wants to drive during that particular part of the driving test. You can't hold it against me if I crash into a pedestrian and kill them. So with that caveat, I would like a driver's license, please. That seems like something that was intended when we were talking about the religious freedom protected under the First Amendment.
Yeah, obviously that is a clear-cut example of the absurdity of extending religious freedom to action, right?
As opposed to just belief.
Just belief, yes. So your right to practice in your own home and believe what you want is unconditional in the United States, and as it should be.
Okay.
But your ability to affect others, and that is not unconditional, and it can't be.
Your right to exercise your religion ends where the rights of other people begin, including orphans. Just because they're orphans doesn't mean they don't have rights. Okay, so how does Bates... So Bates says, applies, I'll do everything, but I'm not going to do that. And then she hooks up with one of those terrible groups out there. Who is it?
Yeah, so Bates gets represented here by the Alliance Defending Freedom.
Oh, ADF.
ADF, yes. Which is, you know, one of the many Orwellian-named organizations that all do the same thing, which is try to promote white Christian nationalist agenda and try to elevate the beliefs of white Christian nationalists above minority religious and non-religious people in the country.
Yeah, I mean, and ADF is like, well, probably the biggest, most effective one of those Christian nationalist organizations. I mean, it's been really active for certainly as long as I've been doing this, but more like two decades, it's been really powerful. I mean, they were helped push a lot of the narratives in the God's Not Dead movies. I was just recalling this the other day. A lot of people forget about that. There's actually, like, at the end of the movies, there's this list of real life cases that appear in the credits, which are all, a lot of them are bullshit, but like the Hobby Lobby case is in there, the Masterpiece Cake Shop case is in there. And the one quote about ADF that always stuck out to me was, on their website, for a short time, they changed it. When they were talking about training young attorneys with their Blackstone Fellowship, which Amy Coney Barrett taught and which Josh Hawley taught, ADF described this, was that they, quote, seek to recover the robust Christian domic theology of the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries. So, they're on a fucking crusade. I mean, that is what that means. Like, they are on a crusade. They want a Holy Roman Empire. That's what they want the United States to be. That is, they are yearning for the days when it is just full political power for Christians, where that is fully unified with the state and everybody else can just basically fuck right off, which I know you can't say because you're here representing FFRF, but I can because I'm me.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
I didn't realize I was representing FFRF.
Yet. Oh, you can represent yourself and drop some F-bombs with me, my friend.
Yeah, they. I know you've got to be clear. Yeah, they can fuck right off. spoken on behalf of myself alone. ADF. Yeah, I don't want to give them too much credit because they're not particularly brilliant, but they are very fairly pervasive.
Yes.
In their influence.
Good point.
I don't know that they've done anything to be as effective as they are. I don't know that they deserve the credit.
Yeah.
But
no, I think that's just that is an
some very powerful conflict. Interests on their side, and they've been sort of handed this situation where the courts are on their side and they can do no wrong.
That's such an important qualification and nuance that I think is lost, especially when the mainstream media talks about this kind of stuff, right? It's like they're not that good at their job. And in terms of persuasive attorneys, like, they're kind of shitty. Like, and a lot of their stuff is a lot of their writings are genuinely not that good, but the entire deck is stacked in their favor, right? They're part of this multi-billion dollar network that has helped capture the US Supreme Court. And they've got 6 justices that they know are going to decide cases in their favor when they bring them. So they don't have to be good, and they're genuinely not. The thing that they're good at is fundraising, which allows them to hire more lawyers and bring more of these cases, which is really the only way that they're effective. It's just that they're more omnipresent, unlike their God. Okay, so Bates hooks up with ADF.
ADF
brings the case. And then what happens?
Yeah. And so, I mean, if you want to get into the technical part of it, there's a motion for a preliminary injunction. Bates files this motion to say, basically, before you decide the case, court, we just need to make sure that during the case, I can have a child from the foster care system. I want to start raising the child right now, someone, you know, under the age of 10, bring him into my home. And before you've even decided the outcome of whether or not I'm allowed to, you know, have a child, I need one. That's the motion she files.
And it's backward, right? Because like that motion is meant to, effectively those motions are meant to protect the status quo, to say like, whatever the merits of this case is going to fall out, we're going to leave things the way they are now so that there's no irreparable harm done. We talked about this last week on the pod with the Department of Education decision that the Supreme Court issued on the shadow docket, where it's one of these preliminary decisions and it's happening on the emergency docket, but the court is saying, yes, you can fire thousands of employees before even deciding whether the administration has the power to do that. Do they have the power to destroy a an agency that the Congress has passed and required to be created, well, the court's going to let it happen, and then they'll decide whether or not the president has the power. It's a similar thing that you're talking about here.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And so the federal district court judge rightly says, no, I think we're probably going to try to decide the case before we put a child in your home. Mm-hmm. So preliminary injunction motion denied. And Bates says, well, I would actually like to win that one, so we're going to appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which hears cases in Oregon, California, Washington, and a few other flyover states.
And so,
sorry, flyover states.
And so, the cases at the Ninth Circuit, and but I already mentioned it was a bad decision, but tell us a little bit about the argument that you and Kat and Alex made in the brief for AU and FFRF. What were we arguing in this case?
Yeah, so we argued a couple things, one of which was this idea that you just so eloquently stated, which is that no, we have to preserve the status quo here. And the status quo is we don't put kids in foster situations where the parents aren't meeting the requirements, right? Like, yeah, Bates is not an adequate parent for the foster care system purposes.
By her own admission.
By her own admission, right? The state of Oregon has an obligation to make sure that all the kids in its care are only going to qualified homes. And Bates does not qualify. That's the status quo, right? And so we're saying, think about it this way. If we put a kid in Bates' home right now, and then ultimately the case is decided against Bates, what do we do? We remove the kid from her home and like take the child back into the foster care system.
Yeah, it's like another
outrageous result.
Yeah, it's another traumatic transition for a kid who's in this terrible system already. That it's sort of it's shooting yourself in the foot to allow this to move forward.
Yeah, and conversely, having Bates wait harms no child. Bates has to wait, yes, but I mean she's the one who's not meeting the requirements. So let's just
let the case play out. Showing harm is usually a part of this. So what does the court say is the harm that she is going to suffer from not being able to adopt right now versus when the court decides on the case on the merits, like maybe a year from now?
Yeah, the court doesn't really
that's good.
Press the issue thoroughly, but the harm is. It's sort of a justice delayed is justice denied sort of logic where, oh, well, like she needs a child and, you know, denying her a child is, I don't know. Yeah. Temporarily not letting her do this does not seem like the greatest harm when her qualifications to be a foster care parent are in question.
Yeah. When it could end up in harming a child, especially. Yeah.
Yeah. But there are other factors that the court weighs, and the harm to a child versus the harm to Bates seems to be a factor that the court didn't fully consider.
So that's one of the arguments. What's the other argument that you're making?
Yeah, so there are consequences here that reach beyond this one requirement in the foster care program, right? If as soon as you have this case as precedent in the state of Oregon, there are a number of other requirements that Oregon requires of its foster care parents that could equally come under fire based on, you know, religious freedom arguments, right? So the Oregon Foster Children's Bill of Rights is a document that outlines what all the children in the state's care and custody can expect. And, you know, there's all sorts of protections put in place for children, like the right to not be abused, right? And we point out in our brief that there is a fundamentalist Christian mindset out there,
yeah,
exemplified in books like To Train Up a Child, that recommends, you know, physically harming children in order to keep them in line.
Yeah, I mean, right? This is one of the things that when I was reading the opinion that was that just kept, you know, kind of bouncing around in my brain is like you don't have to change the facts of this that much to get to a place where the harm to kids is obvious, right? I mean, like the Bible, those books that you're talking about say that, but like the Bible, Proverbs 13:24 tells us that if we spare the rod, we're going to spoil the child. So you could imagine very easily a potential adoptive or foster parent in this same situation that says, no, God requires me to beat kids to put them in line. Not just beat them, but beat them with a rod, right? Like, this is the same case as what we are talking about here. Like, there is a requirement to keep kids physically safe, and their God says differently. And I gotta believe that in a case like that, this same set of judges would have come down a different way, though maybe not. I mean, these days it is difficult to tell. But so there is this element, I think, of like the anti-LGBTQ aspect of this, and one of the things that was in the brief was I believe it was the FFRFAU brief, was how many kids are in foster care as a result of kind of these LGBTQ characteristics, and then no longer being welcome in their religious home, getting kicked out of their houses, that there's a higher proportion, of LGBTQ kids in the foster care system because they come from religious households and stuff. And we're talking about forcing them back into this. It's unconscionable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's really easy to imagine this hypothetical. Now that Bates has won this preliminary injunction, she's going to get a child under the age of 10, right? She's specifically only looking for a kid who's in the elementary school age range. So that's a child who doesn't necessarily fully know their own sexual orientation and identity, or is not expressing it. Even if, you know, deep down they do know, they might not be willing to express it to adults or willing to express it to the state prior to being placed in the foster care system. So Bates could end up with a child easily who doesn't fit, you know, her specific Christian ideal of what a child's sexual orientation and gender identity should be. And then what? She has this child, the child starts expressing views that don't align with hers, and she, what, puts them in conversion therapy, right? This you know, well-known practice that's just... is just a cover for physical abuse of children, psychological abuse of children, in order to, you know, fix what Christian nationalists view as a choice, right? Even though it's an innate characteristic of a child.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many just horrific stories of parents and adoptive parents trying to, you know, not just pray away the gay, but beat away the gay, or conversion therapy away the gay, or you know, put him in a dark room, you know, bread and water away the gay, like all these terrible things. And it, to me, that hypo that you just mentioned, that's what gets to sort of, it undercuts the majority's opinion. Because one of the things that the majority says is like, they kind of take up this argument as like, look, there may be some good reasons here for the state, but the state didn't narrowly tailor their interest in protecting that child to this in a way that also allows this religious belief to exist. Basically saying, like, just don't give her an LGBTQ kid and everything will be fine. Right? Like, that's kind of what the majority is getting at. But and your hypo right here just completely shows why that is bullshit, because that the idea that this is not narrowly tailored just ignores the realities of sex and gender and sexual orientation and how children mature and go through puberty and all this other stuff. Like, it's so easy to see her adopting or fostering an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old who just has no idea about that stuff. And then all of a sudden is going to be in this just hostile environment where they're going to be, you know, suffocated. It's awful.
Yeah. And there are real documented psychological disadvantages to children who experience parental rejection, right?
Yeah.
And that's what we are potentially setting up a child for. What the state of Oregon is now being directed to set up a child for in the case of Bates, right? We're going to put you into this home with this person who may reject you if you don't measure up to her specific religious ideals. And there's nothing that the state can do to stop that now.
I mean, you know, one of the things that always strikes me about these cases, the religious freedom cases, especially the ones that are wrongly decided like this, is the way that they center the wrong people, Right? Like this is centering this bigot who she has a right to exercise her religion. Nobody is stopping that. She is free to not use people's preferred pronouns, to not take people to transition appointments. Nothing is forcing her to do that. She is free to be a bigot. The question comes when she also wants to do these other things that are not related to religion. Does she have the right to exercise her religion without any consequences? Does she have the right to exercise her religion and impose that religion on another person in a way that might harm them? And the answer there is absolutely not. But you read the majority opinion here, and it's so focused on this woman to the exclusion of the children. And this is the thing that I loved about the dissent, is the dissent begins with a quote that says, this case is about children. And it's like, yes, finally, thank you. Somebody is getting... Now, I know you all did an excellent job in your brief, but talk to us a little bit about the dissent, if you would.
Yeah. So, I mean, the dissent's main takeaways are a little bit technical. It's about the standard of review that the court should apply to the claims being made by Bates. And the dissent would find in favor of the state under intermediate scrutiny, which is a slightly lesser standard than the strict scrutiny that the majority applies. And that's just in part because Bates' interests are coming up against a rule that applies to everyone, right? The state hasn't targeted religion here, right? The rule is about, okay, all parents need to support the child that we place in their care, regardless of their, and then it lists, you know, ethnicity and sexual orientation and heritage and things like that. Basically, it's not targeting religion. And for that reason, this judge would not hold the state to this extreme standard of review. And I want to talk a little bit more about the narrowly tailored element in the opinion. Because what the majority finds in siding with the Christian bigot is that the state had other ways to protect the children. And of course they fucking did, right? The state should not be punished here for layering on protections for children in different ways,
yeah.
Right? Like, yes, in addition to requiring parents to make this pledge to accept children, they also have a system for trying to match up parents with children based on commonalities, right? They're not just throwing any kid in with any parent. They're trying to match up worldviews and, you know, other priorities.
Yeah.
It's a holistic approach. And the majority approach to that and says, oh, well, you can just do that. And you don't need this other thing where Bates has to, you know, pledge to support an LGBTQ plus child. And that's wrong.
Yeah.
The state should be able to layer multiple protections to ensure that kids are properly placed.
You know, one of the things that struck me when I was reading that section was, it also, they've wrecked that section, or that protection in a way too, because it's very easy to imagine a Christian who believes it is their duty, their God-given duty, to convert non-Christians, and especially children in the 4 to 14 window, which, if you're not familiar with that, have fun down that rabbit hole. But, like, you know, and seeing a Christian parent saying, no, you have to give me a child who is not a Christian or does not come from a Christian household, or, you know, was Jewish, was from a Jewish household or was from an atheist household, so that I can convert them because my religion says so. And under this rationale, yeah, the state has to. The state can't protect that kid.
Yeah, it's a pretty clearly fraught outcome, right? There's a lot left up in the air now, a lot of open questions about how a potential foster child is going to be treated in Bates' home, right? And yes, there are open questions whenever a placement happens, right? There's always the potential that it doesn't work out. But the court has taken one tool away from the state of Oregon that it was using to help try to keep protections as high as possible for the children in its care. And it's a real shame.
Do you have an idea of what what is next for this case, because it's ADF versus the state. ADF wins here. Do we think we're getting en banc? Do you think we're going to SCOTUS? What do you expect?
If I were the state of Oregon, I would probably move for en banc review. The dissent is not blistering. It's respectful, but it's very passionate as well. The dissenting judge points out just how much potential harm could come from this outcome.
And this was a Trump judge and a Clinton judge in the majority, I believe, right?
We'll just say
I'm right, and people will fact check me, and that'll lead to engagement. So hopefully, I'm a little bit wrong.
Yeah, leave a comment, like and subscribe.
thank you, Sam. Somebody needs to do that work. Okay, but for folks who don't know, en banc is when, instead of a three-judge panel deciding a case, the one of the parties can ask all of the judges on a circuit to look at it and then redo it. That's not mandatory. It's permissive, so the court may or may not do it. But that's what you think next step here.
I would seriously consider that if I were the state of Oregon here. The Ninth Circuit used to be one of the more liberal-leaning circuits in the country. And so 8 years ago, I would have expected the Ninth Circuit as a whole to side with the state over Bates here. Now, after Trump's first term, where he appointed judges to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the circuit is much more closely divided. And, you know, that's a phenomenon that we've seen nationally
across the board
in most of the courts of appeals and the Supreme Court, obviously. So there are real consequences to Trump's first term in office. And we're beginning to see those consequences exacerbated here in his second term.
Real disastrous. Sam, before we go, last thing I wanted to ask you is, can you just mention Cat Grant's contribution to the brief and what they've done and how it is to work with them?
Yeah. So this brief was first and foremost drafted by Kat. They were a legal fellow for FFRF at the time, and they're very passionate about LGBTQ+ issues. They're, I believe, currently working for an organization that focuses more primarily on LGBTQ+ protections and rights in general. And I definitely want to thank Kat for their work on the brief and for the other work they've done for FFRF, including a lot of blogs and other public-facing work just explaining the importance of protecting LGBTQ+ people and their rights and how that is an issue that relates to free thought.
Yeah, just a lot of great intersectional work there at the crossroads of LGBTQ+ rights and church-state separation. So, yes, thank you, Kat, for that. Sam, thanks for joining me, buddy. This is so fun. Next time...
Andrew, I'm delighted. it's been such a long... I've been listening to the podcast regularly and thinking to myself, you know what? I would interject there and call Andrew out on his bullshit. I don't know. I don't know exactly what I want to interject on, but I don't think I disagreed with you on anything here or in general.
And just so folks know, like next time we're going to try to do this in person, because like you helped me out here, like last second you jumped on, like very last second to do this. And like next time I think we're going to try to do it in person. Maybe we'll do it around the fire pit with some beers or things like that. But it'll be, yeah. I mean,
I would love that. I would love to be on one of your bonus content things for subscribers.
Yeah.
You really should subscribe and fully pitch in so Andrew can keep doing this important work. And then you'll get to share a scotch with me and Andrew at some future date.
Yes. And I'll see you at the lake tomorrow, buddy.
Yeah, can't wait.
All right. Okay, it is just so much fun to be able to record with your friends. Thank you all for entertaining me with that. Few other things to note this week that are important that we're going to cruise through real fast. Republicans in the House under Mike Johnson, Christian nationalist Mike Johnson, have adjourned until September. They're taking like a a bunch of weeks of vacation. Why? To avoid having to vote on releasing the Epstein files. This is the same Congress that worked late into the night on a holiday to take away our health care, to force a nationwide system of school vouchers on us, to enrich billionaires. And then Mike Johnson has them all skip town when it comes to catching groomers, but work like dogs when it comes to rewarding billionaires. I mean, this really does tell you all you need to know about the Republican Party in this day and age and what it cares about. To distract from the fact that Trump is in the Epstein files, the Trump regime is accusing President Obama of treason, a crime that carries the death penalty. That is in the Constitution. The conspiracy Gabbard, Tulsi Gabbard, just a nightmare of a person, is spinning. To distract from Trump's connection to a known pedophile and human trafficker is insane and is nonsensical. And I mean, truly just does not live up to anything reality-based whatsoever, but I don't think it's something that we can take lightly. I don't want to get into the full details about it because it is an attempt to distract, and I don't want to give into that, but they escalate everything, and I think this accusation is something that we probably need to worry about, and if I was President Obama, I would not be just letting run off my back like water off a duck's back. You know what I'm trying to say? I'm not getting it, especially for a bird nerd, and I need to get that right. But anyway, you know what's a better bird than a duck? No, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't rank birds, but loons. Loons are just such cool birds. Babies cruise around on their back. Love it. I'm hoping to see one up at the lake with Sam this weekend. Continuing to borrow from the Nation, hell is a place in Gaza. And having studied this at the University of Amsterdam, yes, it is a genocide. The Trump regime is still disappearing people and sending them to foreign prisons with no due process to be tortured. That is happening. I was thinking about Abu Ghraib the other day and that scandal and how we knew the names of the soldiers who were responsible for that and it followed them around forever. This should be the same. The Trump regime is disappearing people and sending them to foreign prisons with no due process to be tortured. Colombia's settlement with the Trump regime is foolish and is gonna backfire. The interim president of what was formerly known as King's College before we declared independence, and which should probably readopt that name given its sycophantic tendencies, thinks that this settlement with Trump is gonna help the school, quote, turn the page. Whew, man, is that a foolish statement for anyone in higher education to utter. Just spend a few minutes talking with some of your professors about what happens when you capitulate to an authoritarian. See how well that goes. You think Trump is going to leave you alone now that he sees you as weak and as a target and as somebody he can squeeze $200 million out of? He is going to come back for more because you didn't fight back. And lastly, South Park. I watched the entire episode. Look, South Park came out when I was in ninth grade and I loved it at the time. I thought it was so hilarious. The irreverence, the idea that sacred cows make the best hamburger, all of it. You know, it was up my alley at that point in my life. And I still think Book of Mormon is one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. My stomach hurt the day after I watched Book of Mormon because I had been laughing so hard. I pulled an ab muscle laughing at the Book of Mormon. The church-state stuff in the South Park episode is actually really good. There's a scene where one of the parents is talking to his AI and asking, basically, what are the rules for church and state in a public school? And the AI, like, nails it. South Park, like, really nailed it. The anti-LGBTQ bigotry in there is terrible. But the mockery of Trump in this episode is a must, and it's something that I think we need to see more of. Just the straight up mockery, embarrassing this man, hanging him out there as just this tiny small person that he is. We need to see more of that. Mockery and dissent and criticism of power are the beginnings of freedom. the same way that mockery and dissent and criticism of religion is the beginning of freedom. And it is something that authoritarians cannot stand. They cannot survive either. So I would like to see more of this. And I'm hoping with South Park punching back and what's happening to Colbert and the comedians beginning to punch back, we're going to see more and more and more of this. Until next time, my friends, life is too good to waste on bad ideas. This has been One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew Seidel. Until next time.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.